Chapter 6, Lie Number 6. The New Testament is New. What is the New Testament? If you had to define it, how would you do so? Is it a collection of books and letters written in the first century? Is it the divinely inspired Word of God? Is it a chronicle of how everything changed with Jesus? At the very least, almost all Christians could agree that the New Testament is commentary on the first, or Old Testament, due to the fact that every single book and letter deals with events and predictions spoken of in the Old Testament, and because the New Testament quotes almost exclusively out of the Old. What is it, besides the name, that makes the New Testament new? The word new has far-reaching implications. New can have completely different connotations depending upon how the word is used. Oftentimes, new is used synonymously with better. I have a new car or a new phone. However, new can also mean another, untested, or lacking maturity, as in, I'm going to try out a new recipe, or the quarterback has a new injury, etc. If you have the New Testament, for example, but I have the old one, generally your new one makes my old one obsolete. And that's all fine and dandy if we're talking about covenants. Yet almost no one to whom I have spoken about the Bible thinks of covenants when talking about the Old and New Testaments. We think about books, letters, or authoritative scriptures. The Hebrew word rendered new, as in the New Testament, not only allows for, but I believe leans heavily toward a much better rendering of renewed. Even the word testament was a choice by the translators to convey the meaning of the word covenant. You see, covenant is what the entire Bible is about. Both testaments are chock full of covenants. Covenants that God makes with persons, with the heavens, with the earth, among others. And likewise, we have persons making covenants with God, with each other, and so on. There are two covenants of prime importance that we will focus on in this chapter. The first covenant that God made with Israel on Mount Sinai, and a second covenant that He will make with Israel after the days of Jeremiah. God chose Israel out of all other Gentiles, or nations. He proposed to her, and she accepted. Promises were made, vows were exchanged, but what Christianity mistook for a simple, loving relationship between Creator and humankind, because we strayed off course so long ago, was in reality a marriage between God and Israel. Please remember that. If you were to have any doubts, concerns, or questions about God's marriage to Israel, please see Hosea 2, Jeremiah chapters 3 and 31, and Isaiah 54, among many other passages. Israel is God's first and only bride all the way through the Bible. In Matthew, Jesus is still talking about brides, bridegrooms, wedding feasts, and guess who the groom is? We all know the groom is Jesus. But here is where things get a bit tricky. Who is the bride that he is going to marry? Lots of fodder for discussion here, but Christians all know that Christ is going to marry the church. Ephesians 3 and 5 cover all that ground more than adequately. Except you have inherited another lie. This lie is so good, so sneaky, so subtle, that 1,700 years later, we still do not see the monumental contradiction staring us dead in the face if church means what we have all been told that it means. We were told that the church is the body of believers in Jesus Christ, and that is true, sort of. Christianity has a nasty habit of starting at the end and working her way backwards up to a point. For example, the word church does not appear in our English Bibles anywhere in the entire Old Testament. That's right, not even once. Then, like a mysterious apparition, it suddenly materializes in the 16th chapter of Matthew. What you, the reader, may not know is that the word church has an interesting past. Church is not an old word. Anyone can do a study of the word church, whether through theological dictionaries, Greek lexicons, or etymological reference materials, to verify the information in this section. A noteworthy excerpt from Smith's Bible Dictionary, 1884 edition, page 452 says, "The derivation of the word church is uncertain. It is found in the Teutonic and Slavonic languages and answers to the derivatives of ecclesia, which are naturally found in the Romance languages and by foreign importation elsewhere. The word is generally said to be derived from the Greek kuriakos, meaning the Lord's house, but the derivation has been too hastily assumed. It is probably associated with the Scottish kirke, the Latin circus, the Greek kloukos, because the congregations were gathered in circles." My point is not that the English word church is closer to the Latin word circus than the word assembly in its etymology. My point is that the word church does not derive from the word ecclesia, either in form or function. This is a borrowed word, as are most English words, but the problem is that it is not borrowed from the New Testament Greek word ekklesia, which was clearly translated as assembly or congregation in the Septuagint, and always means persons who are gathered or assembled. The word church seems to have its origin in the place where worshipers gathered, and not in the worshipers themselves. King James VIII. The following text appears verbatim on the website www.thekingsbible.com. The King James Bible Project started in 1604. Archbishop Richard Bancroft was appointed the principal overseer. King James wrote to Bancroft with a list of suggested instructions of his own. The King's letter to Bancroft still exists in the library at Lambeth Palace. The palace has been the official residence of the Church of England archbishops for over 700 years. The date on the King's letter shows that he wrote it 6 months after the conference at Hampton Court Palace, where the project was initiated. There is little doubt that Bancroft considered the King's suggestions. However, many of the King's instructions were not implemented. Dear reader, King James wrote 15 edicts that he wanted to be employed in the translation of the King James Version. As noted above, many of the King's instructions were not implemented. However, Edict number 3 was implemented to a T. Edict number 3. The old ecclesiastical words to be kept, as the word church, not to be translated congregation. My question is why King James wanted the word church maintained over the translation of congregation, associated with the original meaning of the Old Testament word kahal, and the Septuagint's synagoge and ecclesia. King James knew the correct translation as he stated in the third edict. So, why did he change it? In the Torah and the Prophets, the Hebrew word is kahal, and it means assembly, company, or congregation. When translating the Old Testament Hebrew into Old Testament Greek, the Septuagint used two words, ekklesia and synagoge. However, in the New Testament, for some bizarre reason, the translators rendered the word synagoge as synagogue, and the word ekklesia became church. Ekklesia means called out ones, gathering, congregation, and assembly, and always refers to persons, not locations. The Hebrew word kahal was primarily translated using two Greek words, synagoge and ekklesia. Both words are used interchangeably or synonymously throughout the entirety of the Septuagint as assembly or congregation. So why then do our English Old Testaments not translate the words synagoge and ekklesia as synagogue and church, respectively? Or, an even better question is, why is there a sharp distinction between synagogue and church in the New Testament if they are used interchangeably in the Old? Why did King James VIII specifically instruct the translators to use the word church and not use the word congregation in the New Testament? Those are great questions that demand great answers, but don't hold your breath. Had our beloved translators of the New Testament Greek into New Testament English consulted their Septuagints for how those same words were translated back then, there would have been no discontinuity whatsoever from one testament to the other. We would all be reading that God's kahal, His assembly, remains His assembly from Exodus all the way through to Revelation. But, once again, when translating the New Testament into English, the Old Testament terms and definitions were left neatly in the Old Testament. 58 times the word synagoge appears in the New Testament. 57 times it was translated synagogue. Only in James chapter 2 and verse 2 did they translate it assembly. Why? Why would they not translate the exact same word as assembly the other 57 times? Acts 14:1. Acts 17:1 and Acts 17:10 all provide curiously redundant descriptions of synagogues if synagogue means what we all understand a synagogue to be, a Jewish place of worship as opposed to a church or a Christian place of worship. Now, at Iconium, they entered together into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Greeks believed. Acts 14, verse 1. This passage leaves one scratching her head asking, what other kind of synagogues were there? And why were there a great number of Greeks attending synagogue in the first place? Now, when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Acts 17 and verse 1. Again, one wonders, if this was a synagogue of the Jews, where were all the synagogues that were not of the Jews? The brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea, and when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. Acts 17 and verse 10. I am no expert in biblical languages, but I don't have to be. After all known languages function in similar capacities. All languages contain nouns, verbs, and adjectives. The primary function of an adjective is to modify or describe a noun. Adjectives may be used to describe the qualities of someone or something independently. Take the word sharp as an example. If I take one knife out of my drawer and feel of the edge with my thumb, I say, wow, this knife is sharp. I am describing the quality of that knife independently. But if I ask my buddy to hand me a knife from the drawer and he says, which one? I then say, hand me the sharp one, please. In this case, I am using the adjective sharp contrastively, or in comparison with the other knives in the drawer. I need the sharp knife and not the other knives that are not as sharp. In the three passages above, what possible benefit is achieved by letting the reader know that in chapter 14, Paul and Barnabas went into a Jewish synagogue, or that Paul and Silas went into a synagogue of the Jews in chapter 17. Are these uses of the words Jewish and of the Jews in the passages above describing the quality of the synagogue independently, or are those adjectives being used comparatively? The very fact that the synagogue is described as Jewish or of the Jews begs the question, what other kind of synagogues were there? Aren't all synagogues Jewish or of the Jews? If not, and the adjectives Jewish and of the Jews are being used comparatively, then my point is only strengthened. The word synagogue in Acts chapters 14 and 17 has to mean gathering or assembly, and not the building where Jewish people go to worship. If Paul and Silas went into a Jewish gathering, or Barnabas and Paul went into a Jewish assembly, then the adjectival comparative meaning of Jewish or of the Jews makes perfect sense, because those gatherings or assemblies were Jewish and not Asian or Corinthian or Roman. You see, if one does not read both the First and the Second Testaments as one continuous story, from the beginning all the way through to the end, one will most certainly miss the fact that God, expressed as a human being, is going to remarry his one and only bride. He calls this bride his kahal, which is to say his ekklesia or synagogue, which, no matter what language you speak or read, they all mean his congregation or assembly. And who has his assembly always been and always will be? Israel, period. This is Jeremiah 31 and verse 31. The forecast calls for a renewed covenant. There was a promised covenant which was to come in the future. It was to be a renewing of the first covenant. It is the very same covenant that the entire Bible has been speaking about all along, the covenant of marriage between the Lord and his bride, Israel. When you and I hear the words New Testament, the first thing to come to mind is the canon of books written after the prophet Malachi. That is not the meaning of the word testament in either the Old or the New Testaments. The word testament would be much better rendered as covenant. Jeremiah 31:31 is the exact place in Scripture where the New Testament gets its name. Yet all translations of the aforementioned text of Jeremiah render verse 31 New Covenant and not New Testament. That's right, all translations, at least all that I could find in English, render Jeremiah 31:31 New Covenant and not New Testament. It is odd and unfortunate that there was not a better understanding of the context of Jeremiah 31 when the New Testament was translated and given its name. Had those translators fully comprehended that the Lord is going to renew his vows with his one and only bride, Israel, I do not believe that they would have chosen either the word new or the word testament. How many married couples decide to renew their vows after 20, 30, or 50 years of marriage? They renew their vows. They don't come up with a completely new set of vows to commemorate the marriage. To renew their vows is to remember, to reaffirm, to reestablish their lifelong commitment to one another in the relationship. The only thing that is new about the renewed covenant is the substance on which the self-same laws will be written. That's it. I will attempt to demonstrate this reality a bit later on. But what the Lord said is that he will write his Torah, which are his teachings and his house rules, on our hearts, in our minds, in our operating systems. Who knows? Maybe even in our DNA. Did you see what I did there? See how subtle that was? We do this all the time in Christianity. I said, the Lord will write His Torah, which are His teachings and His house rules, on our hearts, in our minds, in our operating systems. Oh, you are our. We love to claim all the blessings and good stuff in the Old Testament, but we have a bad habit of shrugging off all the ugly stuff like curses and punishments. Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. That prophecy was for the exiles of the house of Israel that were carried off to Babylon, not for every senior who graduates high school. That is not for you and me. That was for them. But someone will surely say, the blessings are for all of us because we're all part of the same family. Really? If that is true, then why doesn't Christianity take on the curses or the house rules, which are contained inside of God's 10 instructions on how to live, like His instructions on how to eat, and His instructions on how to participate in His appointed times? Aren't we all part of the same big, happy family? But let's not muddle the issue with facts and logic. Please consider with whom the one and only true and living God is going to renew His covenant in Jeremiah 31. Nowhere in Jeremiah does it say that God renews covenant with the church. So, why have we heard so often from our pulpits that Christians are the bride of Christ? Christians reject the idea of being part of Old Testament Israel for various reasons discussed in previous and future chapters of this book. And if we do have to be part of Old Israel through the house of Judah, that is, Jesus, we refuse to receive the house rules, that is, the instructions or laws that Jesus taught that all future Gentile disciples are to obey. Matthew 28, verses 18 through 20. We need to clean our glasses. If God, without ambiguity, stated in Jeremiah 31:31 that He will make a new or renew the covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, then logic would indicate that Christians had better be joined to one of those two houses or else be out of covenant. Another of the lies that our fathers have inherited is that the church has replaced that Old Testament Israel as the new Israel. But think about that for just a minute. What would that make God were He to marry a completely new bride to whom He just happened to give the same name? The implications are almost too sacrilegious to mention. But let's mention them anyway. That would make God a liar. Remember, He vowed to marry Israel and her alone back in Exodus 19. The prophets are replete with depictions of the agony that she, Israel, caused God by committing adultery against Him countless times. He even told Hosea to marry Gomer, the prostitute, so that Hosea could experience in a first-person way how it felt to have the love of his life cheat on him over and over and over again. God cannot marry a new girl by the same name, nor can He marry the same girl by a new name. He can and will only marry the same girl by the same name, for she is the only one to whom He pledged Himself for all time. Defining our terms, many an honest reader of the letter to the Hebrews comes away with a preconditioned response to the 8th chapter and verse 13. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. This passage is not talking about the law of Moses. Not even close. It's talking about the covenant made at Sinai. A law and a covenant are not the same thing, even though they are related. Covenants are relationships that are contingent upon promises, laws, rules, statutes, precepts, made between two or more parties. Laws are rules which a particular community recognizes as regulating the action of its members, and which are enforced by the imposition of penalties. To call a covenant and a law the same thing is to define martial arts as lots of kicking. Yes, kicking is part of it, but so is stretching, breathing, memory, form, strength, agility, weight, and balance. I knew that new meant new. Sometimes new really does mean new. Other times, it does not. Well, golly, how are we supposed to know when new means new and when new means renewed? Well, in most, if not all, cases where there is a discrepancy between one meaning and another, you simply let context be your guide. Record and record are spelled the exact same way. The difference in meaning is attached to the difference in pronunciation. One stresses the first syllable and the other the second. Record, record. In the phrase, "You sound like a broken record," the word record is spelled no differently than the word record. It is context that must aid you in determining one meaning over the other. In the phrase, "We are going to record our new album in the studio today," it is obvious to the native English speaker that a meaning of record is what is meant. How silly to say, "Well, you sound like a broken record," or "We are going to record our new album in the studio today." In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9, King Solomon wrote that there is nothing new under the sun. Now, did he mean new or renewed? Context clearly tells us that he meant new as in novel, without precedent. There is nothing novel or previously unheard of under the sun. All that is or will be has already been. However, in John 13:34, Jesus' words are recorded, but something is amiss. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another." What makes this an odd statement is twofold. On the one hand, this is not a new commandment. Leviticus 19:18 states the exact same thing. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." On the other hand, Jesus did not have the authority to add any new commandments. So, which meaning of new does John 13:34 seem to indicate? If instead of rendering the word new as in something novel, previously unheard of, it were translated as renewed, there would be no oddity in John 13:34 whatsoever. And all anomaly would be muted. Jesus would be simply telling his disciples that he is renewing a very old commandment by bringing it to the forefront of their minds. He would have them remember that love of one another and self-sacrifice are one and the same. If new really means novel and without precedent in Jeremiah 31:31-34, then God is going to make a brand spanking new covenant with someone. But remember, this someone cannot be anyone new. The one with whom the Lord will make his new covenant must be the same bride. Otherwise, the Lord would be countermanding his own words in verse 32 and 33. "Not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. This new covenant will be made with the same bride, the Israel that came out of the land of Egypt after those days. Let's examine both covenants, the one made with Israel at Sinai and the one that will be made with Israel after the days of Jeremiah, in order to see if and how the two differ. Because, after all, the Christian part of the Bible is the new covenant. Therefore, this has everything to do with what we all believe and affirm. Exodus 19, verses 4 through 8. Listen for the three promises that God makes with Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, and you shall be to me a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Now, remember that phrase, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. Cue Paul Harvey. And now the rest of the story. Hold on, the covenant is not over yet. In order to understand how the covenant is to be kept, we need to go to the next chapter, Exodus 20. Remember, beloved reader, that the chapters and verses were added sometime in the mid-16th century. God did not pause and tell Moses to flip to the next tablet of stone because we are now starting the next chapter. Exodus 20 is where the Ten Commandments are given, along with the rest of the laws about gods and altars. Chapter 21 deals with laws about slaves, crimes against humanity, and restitution when a neighbor is injured through negligence. Chapter 22 is more laws on restitution when someone is wronged and what to do with those who practice the dark arts, along with social justice. Chapter 23 deals with laws about impartiality, oppression of others, laws about Sabbaths, appointed times of the Lord, and how to occupy the land that the Lord is giving them. Finally, Exodus 24 and verse 3 is their answer. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." So, that is a summary of the covenant and how Israel would keep the covenant made at Sinai. Let's take a look at the new covenant, which will be made with Israel after those days. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my Torah within them, and I will write it on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." In the covenant made with Israel at Sinai, God said, "Here is what I want you to do. Obey my voice and keep my covenant. That's your end of the bargain. If you do, I promise you the following. You will be my treasured possession. You will be a kingdom of priests, and I will make you a holy nation. Here is what I'd like you to obey: the Ten Commandments, the laws and rules concerning how to treat me, each other, and others who live in and among you. Those are my requirements. Now, if you agree, do you take me to be your lawfully wedded husband?" And all the people answered in unison, saying, "We do." Emphasis mine. The differences between the two covenants. Let's take a look at the two covenants and see what differences there are. 1. At Sinai, God promised to make them a treasured possession among all peoples. 2. In Jeremiah, they will be my people. 3. At Sinai, they will be a kingdom of priests. 4. In Jeremiah, no one will have need for anyone to teach his neighbor or each his brother, saying, "Know the Lord," for they will all know me. 5. At Sinai, they will be a holy nation. 6. In Jeremiah, we usually stop reading at verse 34. "I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sins no more." But please remember that the chapters and verses were added to the text in English in the mid-16th century as a helpful tool, but did not exist in the original Hebrew. That being said, they are not always helpful in that they divide, separate, and at times completely sever the continuity between one thought and another. Take the next two verses of Jeremiah 31 as an appropriate example. Verses 35 and 36. "Thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for light by day, and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If this fixed order departs from before me, declares the Lord, then shall the offspring of Israel cease from being a nation before me forever." Here, God is still making promises inside the context of covenant. And what does he say? Israel will cease to be the nation that God said it would be if the fixed order of the sun, moon, and stars, and the waves all cease doing what they have always done without fail since their inception. In other words, Israel will never cease to be a special or set apart or holy nation before the Lord forever. At Sinai, they are promised to be a holy or set apart nation. In Jeremiah, they are promised to be a holy or set apart nation forever. At Sinai, the Torah was given to Moses and written down on stone tablets. In Jeremiah, please don't miss this, the unchanging Torah will be given directly to the people of Israel and written not on tablets of stone, but on the hearts of the people of Israel. Unpacking the covenant. Here's the breakdown. At Sinai, Israel is promised to be God's treasured possession. In Jeremiah, Israel will be God's people. Treasured possession is the word segula in Hebrew, and its primary meaning is property. Well, that doesn't sound very flattering, does it? To the modern Western ear, it sounds terrible and a lot like slavery. But to the ancient Hebrew, it was beautiful. To become the property of the Almighty meant that he would take care of your every need. You would be clothed, sheltered, fed, given work and fair wages, and protected for as long as you belong to him. In short, both in Exodus and Jeremiah, the Lord said to Israel, "You will be mine." At Sinai, Israel will be a kingdom of priests. What was the function of the priest in ancient Israel and beyond? A priest was required to act as a mediator, which meant that he would represent the divine being to his subjects, and in return, from them to their God. What does Jeremiah say? No longer will Israel need to be taught who their God is, for everyone will know the Lord, from the least to the greatest. That sounds like an entire kingdom of priests to me. At Sinai, they will be a holy nation. In Jeremiah 31, 35, and 36, they will always and forever be a holy or set apart from the rest nation. So, to summarize, the only difference between the covenant at Sinai and the new covenant in Jeremiah is the substance on which the same old laws are to be written. At Sinai, they were written on stone. In Jeremiah, they will be written on human hearts. If you're still not convinced that there is no other difference between the old covenant and the new, listen to Peter write to the exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. Number one, a chosen or selected, not race, but kindred, offspring, family, are the three primary definitions of the word genos in Greek in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. Peter is saying that they are a chosen or special people. Two, a royal priesthood. The word rendered royal is basileon and has a root meaning of kingdom, kingly, regal, and having to do with a king. Gee, that sounds an awful lot like a kingdom of priests. Three, a holy nation. Peter said it exactly like that, and so did God. That one is identical. Four, and finally Peter says, a people for his own possession. Again, this sounds eerily akin to a treasured or personal possession. You'll be my property. Jeremiah was written somewhere between 500 and 600 years before Peter. And Peter shows zero difference in the reckoning of Israel in his day. What is the point? From Sinai to Jeremiah, and from Jeremiah to first century Peter, the promises of who Israel will be simply do not change. So, is God making a new covenant with Israel after those days in Jeremiah? Maybe. Or maybe he's just renewing his covenant with her. Either way, God does not change. Israel does not change. The Torah does not change. So, what changed? Very little. God will write his same old laws on a different medium this time, a human heart rather than a rock. But there is one additional change that is made from old to new, and that change is the greatest news that humankind could possibly receive. What's to keep the renewed covenant from being broken again? The renewed covenant is indeed better than the first covenant, but the question you should have is why? But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. Hebrews 8 and verse 6. I believe this passage to mean that the service that Jesus renders now as high priest after the order of Melchizedek is more excellent than the previous ministry, that of the priesthood after the order of Levi. The covenant he mediates is also better, since it is enacted on better promises. How is the new covenant enacted on better promises, given that we've just determined that the promises are all the same? Ah, the answer is that the renewed covenant is enacted on better promises because the human who made those promises cannot break them. How is this so? We already know that God the Father cannot break his covenant. The amazing thing is that God, expressed as a human being, or Jesus, cannot break his covenantal promises either. Because, once again, God cannot change. If this is true, then does the New Testament really bring all the changes that we've been taught to believe that it brings? That is a question that you, my dear reader, and you alone, must answer.